Session number 26947.
Mr. Jarvis, Reel 4. We were talking about your training on the Stearman PT-17A at Phoenix, number 4 British Flying Training School. And we got onto aerobatics. And so you were just telling us how you actually do some of the various famous forms of aerobatics. What about the... You mentioned the loop before we were cut off.
Well, in simple terms, you would take part of the power off the aeroplane by closing the throttle, allow gravity to build the speed of the aeroplane up, and at a given height, then you would ease back with a control column, and the aircraft then would then start going into a loop situation. But as you began to rise, you then gave maximum power with the throttle, and that which carried you over the loop. And then when you're upside down, you would close the throttle down and then come down again by gravity and then pull out of the subsequent dive and then go into a straight and narrow situation with the introduction of the throttle as necessary.
Now, how about one that used to be very important, especially in the First World War, going into, or more importantly, coming out of a spin?
Ah, with regard to spinning, again, the procedure was fairly straightforward, but initially you had to make sure there were no other aircraft beneath you or approaching you in either direction. And having done a 363-degree turn, you then are back to the original heading, and you're satisfied there's no one beneath you. So then you close the throttle down and pull the stick back, and slowly the speed fell away, and you reach the stalling speed. Now, the aircraft is then begin to judder. At that stage, you touch either the left rudder or the right rudder, and therefore it would turn left or right, and then gradually the nose will drop, and then you'll go into a spin. And how many times you needed to spin, well, it was up to you, probably no more than 4 or 5 times. But when the time came that you needed to recover, the procedure again was fairly straightforward. It was the stick where the control column was pushed forward, and then you applied opposite rudder to the actual spin. And that in turn caused the spin to slow down. And you were then, with the stick forward, it simply meant you then became coming into a resultant dive. You weren't spinning any longer, but you were diving. And then you pulled back on the control column and then eased the throttle forward and then came back to a straight and narrow attitude. Yeah.
Now, you mentioned the immelman, which is a loop with a half roll.
That's right.
What about, well, I think you've described the loop, what about the half roll part?
Well, if we get to the top of the loop, you may remember that at that stage you close the throttle. Now, in this instance, you don't close the throttle. You keep the power on, and then you do a half roll by using the rudder and the ailerons to turn either to the left or to the right. And therefore, when you do that, you're now in a normal attitude, and then you're flying straight and level, but a higher level than when you were when you first went into the actual thing, and going in the opposite direction.
Any other particular? I mean, I don't want to just go through all.
There is an awful lot.
And do you remember any in particular or unusual ones that you learned?
Well. You're talking about aerobatics?
Yes.
But those which you describe are broadly the main ones which you use.
Were you warned against dangerous aerobatics? The classic thing of taking off and doing a loop from takeoff, which is very dangerous.
Well, that you wouldn't be allowed to do that.
That sort of dangerous. And was there a height level?
Oh, yes. Well, you obviously had to go to a safety height. Normally it's about 5,000 or 6,000 feet. Before you'd attempt to do aerobatics, and then constantly making sure there's no one either approaching you or underneath you at the time you're actually doing the aerobatics. Yeah.
Were there some things you were told not to try and do? I mean, were there some tricks that were just regarded as too dangerous?
Well, one was what they called a bunt. That is an outside loop. Instead of going down and climbing upwards by pulling the control column towards you, that you'd go forward and go down and do an outside loop. Now, that it is very dangerous because most aircraft are not stressed to take an outside loop. And apart from that, you're likely to black out very quickly, as far as because the blood is then forced to your head, and you can either black out or red out. Generally, the red out if the blood gets too concentrated on your brain and your eyes. But you're forbidden to do that.
And you obeyed that?
Absolutely. I've never done one in my life, no.
Any other banned manoeuvres, or was that?
I can't remember.
The rest was mainly the height.
That's right. It was mainly the height that determined the safety, yeah.
Were you barred from things like buzzing, you know, trying to scare people?
Well, mustn't do low flying. You had a minimum height of something like about 500 feet. Bear in mind, we were in the desert in Arizona, so you didn't have great deal of obstructions. But at times, you were allowed on certain aspects to fly low, and particularly over the desert, not in built-up areas. And the greatest hazard then could either be cactus plants or telegraph wires that stretched across the desert. But we did at times used to fly under the telegraph wires when we bought. But mind you, it wasn't as dangerous as it sounds. We were able to
but
do that.
But that is very low.
It is very low, yeah. That is really low flying, I quite agree, yeah.
I presume it was in the later stages of your training.
Well, yes, when I'd done advanced Harvard fighter trainers, which had retractable undercarriages, then obviously you could get down quite low, probably 5-10 feet above the ground.
So anything else you were learning in the steerman?
Well, instrument flying, again,
now,
that won't become
very good. How far had that got? Was there anything new in that, or was it very similar to...
Similar to what we were shown, but obviously you had to do it yourself, and then you had other manoeuvres, like recovery from unusual attitudes, whereby, well, what that simply means, the instructor, who's a safety, obviously, pilot at the time, he would let you take over, fly straight and level.
This is
instrument flight. With the hood over, so you couldn't see out the aeroplane. And then he would take the controls, and then he would throw the aeroplane all over the sky and hand it back to you and say, now you get out of it. Recovery from unusual attitudes, they used to call it. And it was you had to use your instruments to try to get them back. And it was not easily, especially when you had gyroscopic instruments that tended to topple, and it took a little while for them to actually settle down again. That wasn't easy, but we had certain standards we had to achieve, and in the main we did achieve it, as far as the instrument flying was concerned.
Anything else in the steerman you were doing? Any combat training at all? Or was
not
it...
really, not with steermans, no. No, we'd used to do cross-country.
Tell us about cross-country. What was the secret? I mean, because that used to be a whole discipline in training. But in the desert, it must have been quite difficult. What were you learning with cross-country flying?
Well, to fly a course accurately, to do map reading, make sure you got from A to B safely, or follow a pattern of courses, which eventually would end up at the airfield that you did depart from.
Was it difficult in the desert? No rivers, no roads, no railways particularly?
Yeah, it wasn't easy, obviously, in relation to countryside over here, where you've got railway lines, rivers, as you mentioned. But no, but we got used to it, and we worked our courses out, and with the Dalton computers, as I mentioned, and then... we used to successfully either by dual flying or solo flying. We used to go from A to B without a great deal of problem.
Yeah. Anything else in the steerman?
Well, we did night flying. Now that was obviously another major discipline, totally different from day flying. And we had flare poles, which were quite primitive, which were what they call gooseneck flares. That is oil, they're lit by oil, which is lit with a taper and with a line of those that kind of down the runway, and you would take off and land guided by those flares.
So once you were up, how did you manage? I mean, was it just instrument flying, or what?
Yes, you had to use your instruments mostly. But being night time, they were fluorescent, and you could see them fairly clearly, quite candidly.
Could you see enough? I mean, was there? Could you? What was the visibility like at night?
Black, utter blackness. Utter blackness. Yeah, that's right.
There's starlight, moon.
You might have stars, moon, but the glow wasn't all that great. And but no, you literally use your instruments, particularly your compass. Now, this came very much into play, going from A to B, or even doing circuits and landings. But most of the earlier night flight was circuits and landings to make sure you got used to landing yourself. And then, of course, after a time, if the instructor was satisfied, then he'd send you solo, and you would fly solo at night time, which wasn't easy.
So as you came into land, the flares would, you'd go back to visibility.
You're not blind landing. You'd then see the flares, and then you'd have an instinct that you were settling down amongst the flares, and then you knew you weren't very high from the ground. Then you gradually pull the control column back into your stomach and sit down, and the wheels then touch down on the runway.
And anything else in the steerman?
That broadly covers most of it, yeah.
And that was your first aircraft?
Yeah, for 2 months that lasted, yeah.
So, and that was the first course?
Absolutely, yeah, the first 2 months, the primary course, yeah.
Now, the second course, what aircraft were you on there?
Oh, then we went under Harvard fighter trainers.
And what were they like?
Well, much more powerful. It was quite a leap from steermans to Harvard. Even instructors said so, they thought it was. But a much more powerful engine. But then you had retractable undercarriages. You had the trimming devices.
What were they? The retractable undercarriage.
Yes.
Presumably, you just meant to put it up and down.
That's right. As when you took off or landed, and then you had flaps, which again you hadn't encountered with steermans, flaps, which are able to fly at a slower rate without reaching the stalling point.
Did they work? What are flaps?
But flaps, it's a section of metal at the trailing edge of a wing, and it is lowered. It's like split from the wing, and it is lowered. And most or all modern aircraft have them, and it simply enables you to fly slower and land slower, before you reach the stalling point.
Was this another two-winger?
This was a Harvard.
It's a
Harvard.
It's a fairly modern-looking...
Oh, yes, it's a fighter trainer. It's a fighter trainer, oh, yes.
So what other aspects of training were you having here? You mentioned the trim. What do you mean by that?
Well, the trim, you had a trim wheel which you actually push forward or back. And the idea is if you're in a straight and level attitude, you then trim the aircraft, so you take the weight off your hands, the controls, and the aeroplane will then fly by itself. Straight and level. That's the idea of it, with the trimming deal. It relieves you of the weight of the controls, yeah.
And anything else about actual flying that you had to learn?
Well, similar to the steerman, you had instrument flying, you had aerobatics. They were somewhat more extreme because it was a very heavy aeroplane, and the aerobatics were quite violent at times, but you had to contend with it, yeah.
And what about, did you start in any way learning fighter tactics? Scout tactics?
As the course went on, you had the middle course and then the advanced course, and that's where you got into air-to-air practice combat with camera guns. Obviously, you didn't use machine guns, but used camera guns, and then you would have pursuit flying with other cadets flying solo all over the sky. and chasing each other. You'd also do formation flying, which is again.
Let's see. Perhaps I should have had it first, but I mean, we'll take the fighter tactics and the pursuit flying. So, what can you give us an idea of what that was like? You were armed with camera guns. When you
camera
did that.
Guns, but obviously not machine guns. That's right. Yeah, and you would take turns, probably go up with another cadet, and one then would take the part of the aircraft being pursued, and the other one was the pursuer, and then you would chase each other all over the sky, try to get on the tail of the one in front of you. That was the job.
That was the main tactic, to get behind.
Right behind, and preferably underneath, so you could fire upwards. If you were in that.
Underneath,
oh yes, so that the pilot doesn't see you coming. That's the main thing, in his mirror. If you're underneath, you won't be seen, yeah.
And how was that best achieved? I mean, were they still teaching things like coming out of the sun or coming out of clouds or that kind of thing?
Well, they didn't emphasise that, but obviously that was a necessity under operational conditions. But the idea, you had two aircraft. One was weaving and diving and doing everything possible to keep away from the one behind, and the one behind was trying desperately to keep behind to get in an attacking situation.
And how realistic, how close would you get to each other? Because there is an obvious risk of flying into the back of each other.
Oh yes, I agree, but you wouldn't get any closer than about 50 feet, something like that, yeah.
But to within what would be gunnery range?
Oh yes, yeah, if you're in 50 feet within, I mean, you're really, the one in front wouldn't stand a chance. Normally about an operational conditions, probably 100 foot would be quite adequate, yeah.
Now, what about gunnery training? I'll come back to formation training, but what about, because we're on it. I mean, you were using a camera gun, but I mean, there's things like deflection shooting, there's use of sights, there's all this sort of things. Mm. How had you been taught that? Had that started on the ground and then gone up? Or?
Yeah, we started on the ground, and then flying instructors would demonstrate to you what was required with regard to deflection flying. But of course, you were unable to see other than with camera guns how successful it was. Because you obviously didn't have live ammunition to see how close you were to the one in front.
So how did you learn on the ground? I mean, what were they?
Well, they showed you films, largely proper operational films with aircraft pursuing German aircraft and seeing how the deflection shots were actually was used. Yeah.
But you didn't fire machine gun. I mean, I don't know what guns they were simulating, but I mean Brownings or whatever.
Let's say Brownings. Yeah.
Would they? You didn't fire anything on the ground.
No.
And in the air, obviously, it was a camera gun.
That's right. Because it was simply a training exercise. Yeah.
How did you feel? Did you feel comfortable with deflection shooting? The theory and practice of it using the lessons.
Well, you knew what was required, and it was just a question of developing a skill. And if you could do that, you would be successful, certainly under real-life conditions.
Was it difficult, deflection shooting, or was it instinctive?
No, it was difficult, but and it certainly wasn't instinctive. It maybe was with some cadets, but most of us, we literally had to train ourselves to make sure that the deflection was exactly the right angle, yeah.
And did you use the sight for that, or did you just work it out for yourself?
No, you used to. You had a gun sight actually mounted on the aeroplane, yeah.
And that had allowances built into it?
Absolutely, yeah. Mm.
Now, you mentioned formation flying. What were the skills of formation flying? I mean, it isn't as easy as people think.
I quite agree. No, the main thing is you got used to the fact that when you're flying, you're not using your eyes. For your own safety condition, the one who is a formation leader, and you either formate on his starboard side or on his port side in echelon conditions generally, and the idea is that you formate on the next aeroplane to you, and so it goes on. However many aircraft actually are formating in that particular time. But the idea, you must not take your eyes off the one that is next to you. that any movement from the leader ripples back down to the through the formation, and the poor chap at the end, he's working his throttle all the time, trying to keep in position with the movement of the other aircraft to take into consideration. Yeah.
Was it difficult to keep good station in the early days?
Yes, it was at the very beginning, but you soon learnt the skill. It was surprising, really, and it was quite pleasant. And quite
was it a knack?
Yeah, I suppose it was, really, yeah. Yes, it was. But we got used to it, and we liked formation flying.
And how far would there be between you, say, and a Harvard?
Well, probably about 30 feet. I wouldn't say any more than about 30. It might even be closer, yeah, yeah.
Now, anything else about the flying to Harvard? Would that be the second two courses?
That's right, the second two courses.
Both courses, the intermediate and the advanced, were on that.
That's right.
Now, how would you, as you were going through, how would you get picked off and sent back?
You were eliminated for various reasons, generally not being able to keep up with the progressive examinations, which you had. There was something like about 9 subjects you had to study, and you had to make sure you kept up to the required standard, because periodically you would have examinations, and naturally the subject examinations went all the way back to the beginning, and the further away you got from the beginning, obviously there's more that you expected to know.
And the failure rate was high?
Fairly high, probably 20%, something like that. Yeah, I would say
20%. So 80% would pass?
Oh, yes, about 80%. Because at that stage, you know, they'd seemed to be having the aptitude to fly, and they obviously wanted to fly. And in the main, they did achieve it. It's quite surprising, yeah.
Now, what about the ground subjects? We covered some of this twice now, but, I mean, was there anything new you were learning on the ground?
No, but they were more advanced. With navigation, we had to move into astro navigation, which obviously is connected with the stars and star constellations. You had to learn the star constellations and then be able, if necessary, during the latter part of your career, to take shots with a sextant so that you could navigate by the stars. But that we more or less had an appreciation of that more than to do it physically, because as pilots, you appreciate, you have to have a knowledge of all trades of aircrew, and including the navigation side. But the navigator, purely navigator, he will be the one who would, with the aid of a sextant, do the take the actual star shots and work out on his course, you know, his position by the aid of stars. But we had to do simple examinations related to that.
Was your maths up to? I mean, was it difficult?
Yes, it was fairly difficult, actually. Yeah, but we coped with it. Yeah.
Now, what about other subjects? How far would you go into wireless and signalling at this stage? I mean, you'd been very good at Morse, but I mean, were you doing part of that as well?
Oh, yes, you had to. As I say, you had about 9 different subjects which covered all the other grades of aircrew, and the wireless operator, normally, say, in a bomber, but generally a wireless operator air gunner, they have to have a very good knowledge of it, but we had to, again, had an appreciation. We knew how to operate wirelesses, what the theory of wireless was, the signalling with Morse code, either audibly or by Aldis lamp, by light. Yeah, by an Aldis lamp, and we could actually transmit and receive Morse by lamp. And that, again, that was important. One of the important things we had to learn from the wireless angle. Engines, much the same, more sophisticated knowledge.
How far with engines were you going? Because, I mean, the engines are getting complex by now.
Oh, yes,
a long way from a petrol engine, from a car engine now.
That's right, yes. Again, we used to have to, we stripped engines down. Harvard engines, for example, they would be in the hangars with the mechanics, and we would go through the aspects of the engines that we needed to know. I can't really say much more than that, but all those subjects, obviously, we're now getting deeper and deeper.
What about
into
gunnery, the sort of air gunner thing? I'm not talking about, you know, I mean, were you actually trained as an air gunner at all?
No, not at
so
all,
you
no.
Didn't, you missed that phase
yeah, I missed
out.
That by.
What
Camera
about,
gunnery was the nearest we got to
and
that.
that's for, yeah. What
Yeah.
about bombing, bomb aiming? Do you do any of that, or the theory of
No,
bombing?
just a theory of bombing from a ground school angle. That's it, really, angles of where bombs were released, height, in relation to height, wind directions, wind speeds, and things like that, yeah.
And was there any sort of training at all in the idea of how to behave as an officer? Or were you expecting to become an officer, or were you expecting to become a sergeant?
No, I personally expected to become a sergeant because most of the our people, something like 90%, were non-commissioned. Only about 10% actually become commissioned. So we accepted the fact we would become sergeant pilots if we graduated.
Did that cause any? It caused no resentment at all, you know.
No, we it didn't bother us particularly. No.
And
all we wanted was the wings.
So, anything else that happened while you were there?
Well, let me see. One little anecdote. I was on a cross-country flight with my flying instructor, Mr. Chapman, on a Harvard exercise, and he with a lot of flying instructors were fascinated about the Blitz in London, the bombing, the burnt houses, all sorts of things like that, because you must appreciate they didn't know what war was about. It was peacetime as far as they were concerned, and they were fascinated by the stories of the cadets, what went on in the Blitz, especially in London. And this particular day, he said to me, "Cadet Jarvis," because I was very formal, Mr. Chapman, Cadet Jarvis, how it always was, and he said, "Last evening, some of the men, cadets in the lounge, was discussing bombing in London and the craters and the fires, etc. But he said, I'll show you a crater now, that's bigger than ever you or your colleagues have ever seen." So naturally, I was quite intrigued about this. And about 3 minutes later, we were flying about 500 feet high, and we passed over the meteor crater in northern Arizona, which is 3/4 of a mile across and 600 feet deep. And I said, "I am suitably impressed, Mr. Chapman." He cracked it.
Now, so what happened next then? This is a 6-month course.
Oh, yes, yeah, 6 months, yeah. And in between courses, we actually had leave about 10 days, and on both occasions, most of us went to Hollywood. Now, again,
tell us about
this is an unusual situation, because Arizona, as you appreciate, is the next state to California, and it was only about 250, 300 miles away from Phoenix. And we used to go there by rule of thumb, which was hitchhiking, or by greyhound coaches, or someone who was kind enough to take us there. And we used to spend all of our time in Hollywood, went to the studios, saw films being made, and the kindness of American people to us young cadets was quite touching, really. They rarely ever allowed us to spend any money. They paid for everything, and it was just a wonderful experience on the two occasions I went to Hollywood.
And what would you do? Would you go drinking, or were you drinking by
Oh,
then?
No, not really.
What
I mean,
would you do?
We didn't drink a great deal. Maybe Coca-Cola was the greatest sort of thing. But no, we went to film studios. One in particular, I went to Paramount and saw one of the old films we made, the road films called The Road to Utopia. And that one with Bob Hope, Dorothy Lamour and Bing Crosby, saw them do a scene several times. It was in the Yukon, in actual fact, the scene with artificial snow, etc. And when they broke for a while in between scenes, they came across, and they were very kind to us, particularly Bob Hope and Dorothy Lamour. they realised, I mean, he being English, obviously, he recognised the RAF uniform and said, we're a long way away from home. And he was quite surprised when he said we were training in Arizona, yes. And but that's one instance. One other interesting aspect is that we met up with C. Aubrey Smith, the elegant English gentleman who was a film star in those days. He always played the part of a colonel. And anyway, he lived in the San Fernando Valley, and he had a cricket club called, naturally, the C. Aubrey Smith Cricket Club. And he invited us, a scratch team of RAF cadets, to play his team a short match. And to our surprise, we beat his team, the actual RAF cadets. But some of our chaps had quite a lot of good cricketed experience while they were at school. So again, it was fun, and certainly meeting him, he was a very nice man.